and welcome to The Bookmonger. I'm John J. Miller of National Review. Thanks for listening. This show is a production of National Review, and we're recording from the studio of WRFH, the campus radio station of Hillsdale College. Our guest is Michael W. McConnell, co-author with Nathan S. Chapman of Agreeing to Disagree, How the Establishment Clause Protects Religious Diversity and Freedom of Conscience. Michael, welcome to The Bookmonger.
Thank you very much, John.
Remind us, what is the Establishment Clause, and why is it so contentious and misunderstood?
The Establishment Clause is part of the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and what it says is that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. And over the years, and especially for several decades at the end of the last century, it became popular to view this as a rule that religion has to be kept out of public life in America. So it was a kind of secularization idea. But what Nathan and I try to show is, both historically and also as a matter of, you know, attractive constitutional principle, it isn't about secularism at all. It's about keeping the government out of the business of telling us what to believe. And so we are free to disagree. And even if we are religious, and so we can, religious people and non-religious people alike are entitled to take their views into the public square.
Why is there so much confusion surrounding it then? Is the First Amendment poorly written, or are we bad readers of it?
Well, at the time it was written, everyone knew what an establishment of religion was. There was an established church in about half of the states, and everyone was familiar with the established church in Britain from which we broke. You know, that's the Church of England. But then we gradually eliminated establishments, and it was well over 100 years, probably 150 years after the last establishment that the Supreme Court began deciding cases. And at that point, they made some historical errors, and it really got us off on the wrong foot.
So why did that happen? Why did they make these errors? Why did these intelligent judges misread the First Amendment?
Well, I think part of it is that they had so little knowledge or experience with historical work on the issue of religion at the founding, and the lawyers who argued before them directed them to a very narrow range of sources and pushed an idea of separation of church and state that is very difficult to sustain. Now, as I say that, let me just say that doesn't mean that separation of church and state is a wrong idea, but just that it is a simplistic idea and really doesn't capture the essence of the Establishment Clause.
So what's so simplistic about it? When you hear the term separation of church and state, you start to think no prayer in public schools and that sort of thing.
I think the no prayer decision was correct, but I think what a lot of people imagine from that metaphor of a wall of separation is that anything in the public life has to be strictly secular, and religion has to be confined to the strictly, you know, private sphere at home and church. And, you know, that wasn't their idea at all. Their idea was that the government shouldn't use its power in order to direct people one way or another with respect to religion. It was no more to promote secularism than it was to promote religion.
So where do we draw the line on this? Where is religion permissible in the public square, and in what cases ought we to exclude it?
Well, it's difficult just to give a, like, say, one sentence answer to that, but the, you know, main principles are that the government can't favor one religion over another, and it can't coerce people into engaging in or not engaging in any particular religion.
There's a big debate right now, and it's been going on for decades, of course, about the public funding of education and whether that can include religious schools, religious instruction, and so forth. What do you think a proper reading of the First Amendment allows and disallows?
So I think that if the government is funding non-governmental schools, private schools, that it has to be non-discriminatory, so it can't favor religious schools, but it also can't disfavor them. It has to treat them equally. And the historical record on this is actually quite powerful, because at the time of disestablishment, when various states were saying, no, no, we are not going to have an established church, even then, they were providing subsidies to colleges, many of which were religious in nature, and no one said, oh, that's an establishment. One thing people often don't know historically or don't realize is we had no public schools, no elementary and secondary public schools at the time of the founding. They don't come about until the middle of the 19th century, and so what you really... The best analog to current questions has to do with higher education, because there were colleges.
Very often, though, we're talking about K-12 education and school choice and scholarships and vouchers and so forth. Do you think the government, federally or at the states, should be able to financially support schools that are religious in character and mission?
Well, I think the state may, although it never has, confine itself to government schools if it wants to. But if it wants to allow private institutions to start schools, private schools, then it has to be neutral with funding those. It can't say, you know, only religious schools can be funded. It can't say only secular schools can be funded. It has to operate on a neutral basis.
How about a situation where that idea clashes with another imperative of civil rights? And I'm thinking, for example, about a Catholic school that doesn't want to hire somebody who is in a gay marriage, for example. Is that religious freedom, or is that a violation of another person's civil rights?
If we're going to have diversity in this country, we have to understand that people take different views on contentious questions. And you know, if you say to a Jewish school, "Oh, you can be Jewish, but you can't observe Saturday as your Sabbath. You have to serve non-kosher food. You have to hire people who don't follow your tenets," then you're not going to have any Jewish school. Same thing with Catholic schools or any others. And so from the very beginning, I mean, we really have not tried to force Catholic schools to give up their moral teachings ever. And I think that was wise. And they're simply treated neutrally, and that produces a diversity of education.
You mentioned that the courts and judges seem to prefer a secular vision of the public square and the place of religion in it. Not so long ago, but in my impression is in recent years or even recent decades maybe, the courts have been a lot friendlier to religious freedom. Is that your sense as well?
I don't think there's any doubt about that. The period of sort of hyper-secular interpretation was maybe between 1970, Lemon versus Kurtzman being a key case in the early 1970s, and about 2000. In the last 20, 25 years, the Supreme Court has slowly walked away from most of that jurisprudence, and instead has operated on a basis of requiring a neutrality and accommodation of religion.
The title of your book is Agreeing to Disagree. It's a common phrase. We hear it all the time. What do you mean by it, though? And how does it connect to this debate about religious freedom and freedom of conscience? Why'd you pick that for your title?
So what we mean by that is that individuals can, you know, adopt the religious or non-religious beliefs of their choice. What the Establishment Clause was is a kind of constitutional deal that we all, you know, struck with one another, that we wouldn't go to the state to try to force you to do something else. So if you believe in Catholicism, you're free to do that. If you're an atheist, you're free to do that. And that the government would not come in and use its power to favor or disfavor one position over another.
One final question. How secure are religious freedoms in the United States today? On the one hand, they're pretty darn secure, it seems like. On the other hand, it also feels like if a few elections go a certain way, they might begin to erode and start to disappear. What do you think the future holds?
Well, I think the law on this is pretty good right now. In fact, I think it is that religious freedom is as secure today or more secure in the courts than it has ever been before. But I do worry about our culture and therefore our politics, that in the last few decades, with the rise of issues that, you know, have to do with sexuality and other matters that, you know, are moral in nature, that Americans have begun to become more divisive and intolerant on the question of religion, as we have on so many other things. But religion has been caught up in these culture wars, and the effect of this is that whereas, you know, a generation ago we might have said, well, live and let live, today there's a real impulse to go in and how dare they say that? How dare they do that? That political impulse is quite dangerous, and the law can restrain that, you know, to an extent. But, you know, if our culture really becomes as intolerant as it sometimes looks as though it is being, it's going to be, you know, tough for the courts to be our savior.
Our guest is Michael W. McConnell, co-author with Nathan S. Chapman of Agreeing to Disagree, How the Establishment Clause Protects Religious Diversity and Freedom of Conscience. Michael, thanks for joining us on The Bookmonger.
Thanks for having me, John.
Thanks to all of you for listening. If you enjoyed this show, please take a minute to leave a review. Your reviews help new listeners discover us, and that helps us keep this show going. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Bookmonger.